All right, we're ready for Genesis chapter 16 and 17. And bear with us tonight in the words of one of my great heroes. Curtis Porter used to begin his speeches in the late 50s when he was ailing, saying, "I feel somewhat physically incapacitated tonight." Yeah, he was suffering from polycythemia vera, but I don't suffer from that, but I understand what he means. Anyway, we're going to talk about Genesis 16 and 17 in our study tonight. This is our outline that we're following. We are in the second section, which has to do with patriarchal history. We're dealing with the birth of Isaac tonight and the birth of Ishmael, which is not listed here, but this is the chosen family in the outline that we're following. Let's review where we've been. Chapter 1 dealt with 6 days of creation. Chapter 2 was man in the Garden of Eden. Chapter 3, Adam and Eve sin. And then 4 was the story of two brothers, Cain and Abel. Chapter 5, important because it deals with genealogy. Those are important chapters, not to say the others are not. Chapter 6 through 9 deal with the flood. So chapter 6 was reason and preparation for the flood. Chapter 7, the flood itself. Chapter 8, Noah comes out of the ark. Chapter 9, God's covenant, Noah's drunkenness. Chapter 10 shifts gears a little bit because now chapter 10 is talking about nations that come from the sons of Noah. Chapter 11 talks about what happened with those nations at the Tower of Babel, the scattering of the nations. Chapter 12, very important chapter. This is where we really shift gears. Yeah, the promised Abraham, or Abram here. His name will change tonight in chapter 17. Chapter 13 was, they returned to Canaan, Abram and Lot. And then chapter 14, there was a war among the kings, and Abram got involved in that. We'll make a point about that tonight if we have time. And then chapter 15 is God, assures him of that covenant. We'll talk more about that covenant in chapter 17 tonight. All right, here's chapter 16 now. Chapter 16, we have a question number one, a short summary of chapter 16. What's chapter 16 about? All right, Hagar and Ishmael. Question number two, why did Abram have a child by Hagar? All right, she was childless and asked him to do that. We'll get to more details of that in a moment. Let's drop down to question four. How did Sarai feel about Hagar after she had a child? Started first with Hagar despising Sarah, and then it was that despisal in return. All right, let's talk about several things here. Let's start with verses 1 to 3. Sarai gives Hagar to Abram to have a child. So let's work through this and talk about some of the things as it relates to other chapters. That Abram's wife had borne him no children, and she had an Egyptian handmaid whose name was Hagar. She may have been part of those that were mentioned in chapter 12 and verse 16. Remember when she was at Pharaoh's household for a brief time when they were trying to take her, that he gave male donkeys and male and female servants. And she may very well have been one of the female servants. So she came probably from that circumstance is where she came from, and she is in the household of Sarah. Now, notice at verse 2, she said, God has restrained me. Now, she seems to blame God here, but we'll say more about that perhaps a little bit later. I'm not interested at this juncture in that. So she says to Abram, please go into my maid, and perhaps I shall obtain children by her. And Abram heeded the voice of his wife, or the voice of Sarai. Let's go on and get verse 3, and we're going to connect several things together. Verse 3, that he took her and she gave him to her as to be his wife. Now that's the last time we're going to see that, at least in our story tonight, because when the angel goes, it's interesting, the angel never tells her his wife. But that was not out of order for the customs of the time. But I want to pay attention to this 10 years that Abram had dwelt in the land of Canaan for 10 years. Let's go back to verse 2. She says to Abram, I want you to take my handmaid and have a child by her so that I'll have a child. That was not totally out of kelter with the customs of the day. And I'm going to give you some evidence of that here in a moment. But one of the things is there has not yet been the indication that the child that Abram's going to have is coming through Sarah. We're going to see that in chapter 17. Now, they should have assumed that, but God hasn't specified that yet. So they're wondering if not this child is going to come from some other matter. At verse 3, the 10 years suggest there's been a long time. That's what I was trying to drive at verse 3. It seems to Abram and Sarah that it's been like a long time. There's been no sign they're going to have a child. And so all of that seems strange to us in our customs, in our society, that if you can't have a child, that you would have a servant. I'm going to let you have a relationship with my servant, and I'll have a child by her. But that very well fit with the customs of the time. Brother Willis, in his work on Genesis, says, in suggesting to Abram that having children through Hagar, Sarai was doing what contemporary customs taught her to do. And he's quoting from Von Rad. I won't read all of these quotations, but Colin Daly says the same thing. It was according to the customs of the East. Here's the handbook on Genesis suggests that it was in line with the family law of the Hurrians, another society in the region at the time of Abram. Here is two more. Here is James Murphy, who said it complies with the customs of the country. And the NET note suggests the social customs of having a child through a surrogate is what she was complying with. So it was not out of total kelter with the customs of the day to not have a child, and then you're going to have it through a surrogate and through a handmaid. That was not totally out of kelter. Was that right? It's not saying it was right. What I'm suggesting to you is they were influenced by culture. And we think we're not influenced by culture. Abram and Sarai were influenced by culture. I still think God's law, some of the commentators talk about it's not sinful to have polygamy. There were times that God tolerated that, but I'm not going to go so far as to say it wasn't sinful, because God's law at the beginning was one man for one woman for life, Genesis 2. That makes sense to me. And any toleration of that, I think, has to be explained in Acts 17 at the times of this ignorance God winked at. God overlooked some things. So there were many Old Testament characters that had multiple women. That doesn't mean God approved of that. It just means God tolerated it at the time of that ignorance. Acts 17 is the only explanation I can give of that. Does that make sense? They were influenced by culture. Now then, let's go to verse 4. Verse 4, so he had a relationship with Hagar. She conceived, and when she realized she conceived, her mistress became despised in her eyes. Now, some wording of some translations of that almost sound like that immediately Sarai despised her, but it was the other way around. It's actually she despised Sarah. She began to look down upon her. Why? There's going to be some conjecture here. We're not exactly told. Some suggest that because she now has a child and Sarah didn't, that she begins to feel superior. And perhaps Abraham is excited about this relationship, or not necessarily the relationship, but the child that's coming, and consequently she feels closer to him. And so she begins to look down upon Sarai. And now then, let's look at verse 5 and 6, because that's true. Who's surprised that this turned south here? Look at verse 5 and 6. What happens in 5 and 6 now? Sarai goes to Abraham, and what does she say to him? What does that mean? Yeah, it was her idea, and then she blames him. Well, hang on a second. I was going to look for another translation too of that, and I thought I had it up, and I don't have that. Several of the translations carry with it the idea of, what verse are we looking at? We're looking at verse 5. Give me a second here. Genesis 16 and 5. Here's the wording of the Holman Christian Standard Bible, that she said to Abram, "You are responsible for my suffering." The NASB, the New American Standard 95, said, "May the wrong done to me be upon you." In other words, she's done me wrong, and I blame you as much as I blame her. That's what she's saying. I'm blaming you, Abram, as much as I blame her. She's done me wrong. She despises me. Now, again, we're not told. It very well may be that Sarah felt like this was going to be one writer suggested today, as I read, that she may have felt like this relationship was not going to be an emotional relationship at all, just a physical relationship to have a child, and maybe it involved more emotion than she anticipated. Maybe Abraham was a little more fond of her than she thought he should be. Or maybe she thought Abram was encouraging that despisal toward her and looking down upon her. That seems to be the case. But I blame you just as much as I blame her. This is your problem. This is your fault. And so at verse 6, his answer to that is to do what? Do as you will with her. It's her handmaid, but he's the head of the household. And so you do with her, even though I have a child through her, then you do with her as you wish. And so she dealt harshly. And so the woman fled. And now she's pregnant and she's taken off. And she's fled away. Now let's go to verses 7 through 16. And in 7 through 16, an angel brought her back. Now let's go back just for a moment to verse 5. Pulpit makes this suggestion for what it's worth, and I don't know what this is worth to you. But when she comes to Abram, I'm going to go back to this suggestion that Sarah made. You go into my handmaid and have a child by her, that she may have the child for us. That pulpit suggests that was testimony to her humility and to her devotion to her husband and her faith in God. In other words, God has promised us a child. And this is their reasoning, whether you agree or not. God has promised us a child. It doesn't look like we've waited 10 years and we're going to have a child. And it's not going to be through us. And so it seems like that it's going to be through maybe my handmaid. And so I believe in the promise of God. I'm devoted to you having a child, so let's have it by my handmaid. And she humbly is willing to relinquish that to her handmaid. Maybe so. I'll leave that for you to decide. I just caught that and thought that was an interesting concept. Nobody else seemed to develop that like Pulpit did. All right. Now let's look at our map here. Well, first, I want you to notice at verse 7. Is it verse 7? Yeah, verse 7. The angel went and found her by the spring, by the waters, by the spring on the way to Shur. All right? Now, you may not can see. This is a little faint. This is from Lagos maps. This is the Dead Sea. This is Hebron, where Abram would reside. Here's Kadesh Barnea. We'll see Bered a little bit later. That'll be a significant place. Somewhere in this region where that flag is where it's thought that she would have fled to. That's the way to Shur, S-H-U-R, there at verse 7. Now, what I want you to notice at verse 7, the angel of the Lord. Now, some think, and there's a big discussion, was this God that appeared? Some think this was the Son of God that appeared in the form of this angel. I think it's more that this was representative of God. This angel was representative of God. I'll leave that for you to decide. I'm not going to get into that discussion. But notice at verse 8 that the angel never addresses her as the wife of Abram, but as Sarai's maid. That's interesting to me. The angel of the Lord didn't call her that. Sarah called. I'll give you her as another wife. But the angel never referred to her as that. Now, what do we make of that? I'm not sure. Maybe God didn't consider her as his wife. But anyway, for whatever that's worth, you can chew on that for a little bit. What does the angel say to her? All right. So what are you doing? And she says, I'm fleeing from the presence of my mistress Sarai. And so the angel said, return and submit yourself under her hand. Go back to where you belong. Now, verse 10, I will multiply your descendants exceedingly, and they shall not be counted for a multitude. In other words, they'll be countless. In other words, there's going to be a multitude that can't be counted. That's the idea. And then notice the angel said, behold, you are with child, and you'll bear a son. You shall call his name Ishmael, which means God hears. Yeah, because the Lord heard your affliction. Now let's stop and talk. And verse 12, he'll be a wild man, and every man be against him, and every man's hand shall be against him, and he shall dwell in the presence of all his brethren. More will be said about him in just a moment. But let's talk about Ishmael. This is the descendants of Abram. Here is Abram. We'll talk about Sarah in a moment, whose name will be changed, chapter 17. And Isaac, we don't know about yet. We'll get to him. There's Keturah, which we don't know about yet. We'll see her in chapter 25 after the death of Sarah. So just kind of ignore her. We'll get to that in chapter 25. But here's Hagar that he has Ishmael by. Now, Ishmael is the father of the Arabs. So this is a modern picture. Whatever, as you know, I'm colorblind, whatever this lighter shade is, those nations that are in that color are representative of the modern Arab nations. They are descendants of Ishmael. Does that make sense? And go back now and read verse 12, that his hand shall be against every man and every man's hand against him. And he would be, verse 12, he'll be a wild man. Well, certainly so. That was true of the Arabs then, and that's true of the Arabs now, for what that may be worth. Now, while we're there, let's go on to verse 13. She called on the name of the Lord, who spoke to her and said, you are the God who sees. Elroah. You are the God who sees. That's a reference to the all-seeing nature of God. And perhaps that's mentioned here because he saw the plight of a runaway woman or runaway girl, whoever she may be, that's pregnant, and had mercy on her. And so she cries out here in this place, here where that basically where that flag is. She cries out to God and she says, you are the God who sees. For I have seen, have I also seen him who sees me? Well, now there's a big question. Let's go to Exodus chapter 33 and verse 20. There's a big question among commentators. Did she actually see God? And is she talking to God? Or is she merely referring to the messenger, who is an angel here, called an angel here? Some think it's the Son of God appearing as an angel. Could be. And some think she actually saw God. And others think, and I want to lean kind of toward this last, that maybe she's just attributing the message from this angel of God being the source and not really thinking she saw God. Now, Exodus 33 and in verse 20, God had said to Moses, you cannot see my face, for no man shall see me and live. So God said to Moses, you didn't see my face. If you did, you wouldn't live. So did she see God's face? Well, I know she didn't see God's face, but she raises a question, have I seen God? I take it that it's a messenger from God, and she didn't actually see God, but she's speaking to God as if that's the source. Now, you may think that was God himself, and so have at that. Now, there was a well there that was, verse 14, that was called Beer-lo-hai-roi. There at verse 14, and observe that it is between Kadesh and Bered. So that's where our little flag is right here. Here's Bered. You may not can see that small print, but my little arrow is right there at Bered. Here's Kadesh. So between them is where she would have been located when the angel found her and brought her back. Now, she bore a son and called his name Ishmael. And Abraham is how old? 86 years old. Make a note of that because some time's going to pass before we get to the next chapter. And that's significant because of waiting on the promise that God indeed gave. All right, questions or comments on chapter 16?
Helping them with their faith.
All right, yeah. This is a testimony to faith because God had made a promise and yet time is passing. 10 years had passed and the promise hadn't been fulfilled. And yet God said, no, this is not the one. They try to work for God, try to help God out. We're going to have a child through Hagar. That doesn't work. That's not God's plan. And yet God doesn't have them have a child immediately. We're going to see more about that in chapter 17. Any other questions or comments?
I'm just thinking that this is similar to from the very beginning. Eve wanted more. She wanted more knowledge than she had. Sarah wanted more. She wanted a child. What all that meant for her status. And then both influenced their husbands to take part in achieving the goals.
All right. Good point. Good point. Real good point. Pulpit, back to chapter 16 and in verse 1, when Sarai, I want to keep calling her Sarah, but Sarai, we'll talk about her name change in a moment, sees that she doesn't have a child, and so she offers her handmaid. Pulpit made this observation, the faith of both, speaking of Abram and Sarah, the faith of both was defective, not indeed with regard to the substance of the promise, but with regard to the method in which it proceeded. I think that's an interesting observation. They believed God's going to do it. They just didn't have faith in exactly how he was going to do that. And so they devised a plan that was not in God's plan. All right, anything else on chapter 16 before we roll into chapter 17? All right, let's go to chapter 17. Here we have circumcision given as a sign. We're going to see a great deal about the faith of Abraham here, as we did in chapter 16 and thus far. Now, in chapter 17, here's what we have. We have four things. First, God promises Abraham that he would be the father of many nations and change his name to Abram. Now, that's interesting now. Now, this comes a little bit later than our time frame. Just keep in mind, we're talking about Abraham being 86 years old. And then we're going to see him at 99 here in just a minute. And so we're going to do some math here in just a moment and talk about how long it was from the time the promise was made till he has a child that God had promised. It wasn't Ishmael. That wasn't the child he'd promised. And that's been 10 years. And now this child is going to be born. That's not the child he promised. And we'll get to that here in chapter 17. All right. In verse 1, when Abraham was 99 years old. Now, my chronology that I'm following may differ from your chronology. I made that point clear early on. So don't get excited if you're off just a little bit from your chronology or following somebody else. But I think we're about 24 years since they entered the land. They are about 400, and at this point, we're 451 years since the flood, and about 2,107 years since Adam. I'm just trying to give a general perspective, even if your chronology's off a little bit. So at this point, we're about, as we mentioned last time, about the same distance, in fact, a little more than we are back to Christ. We're from this point back to creation. Does that make sense? And so we're about 451 years back to the flood, and so about a quarter of a century nearly since they entered the land. By the time these events of chapter 17 take place. So let's talk about this promise to Abraham and his name change. Let's get the first 8 verses. He was 99 years old, and God said to him, I am Almighty God, walk before me and be blameless. There's a whole sermon in that phrase. Walk before me. Pulpit, again, I quote, walk before me, literally set thyself to walk as in my presence. Now, like the rest of this quotation, as if conscious of my inspection and solicitous of my approval, not behind me as if sensible of shortcomings or desirous to elude observation. That's interesting. Do you walk before God? Walk before God as if you are conscious of Him inspecting you and you're solicitous of His approval. Don't walk behind as if you're trying to elude His observation. That's interesting. Walk before me, Abram. And then he says, I will make my covenant between me and you and will multiply you exceedingly. So Abram fell on his face, and God talked with him. Now, what does that suggest to you about him falling on his face? This is going to be important to tie with another point later. Yeah, there's reverence and awe for God. He's already listened to God, done what God said, because we're going to make a point later. What was he defying God a little bit later? I don't think so. And here's one of the points. He falls on his face before God, and then Abram fell on his face, and God talked with him, saying, "As for me, behold, my covenant is with you, and you shall be the father of many nations." So here's still that promise of a nation promise. So in verses 4 and 5, to my knowledge, the seed promise is not mentioned in this chapter, but the nation promise and the land promise both are mentioned. And they're part of this covenant. So verses 4 and 5, if you want to make note, is the nation promise. You're going to be the father of many nations. And no longer will your name be called Abram, but it'll be changed to Abraham. For I have made you the father of many nations. Now what's the name change significance? Abram means, if you look at your footnote, New King James, means exalted father. Abraham means he's the father of many, or the father of a multitude. And so I'm going to change your name to Abraham. And so from this point on, this is a significant point. Now we'll see something about Sarah in a moment, but not just yet. But I'm going to make you the father of many nations. So here's the nation promise. Coming from you is going to be many nations. But he's already told him this is not going to be through this Ishmael. So there's a promise about the nations. Now verse 6, what do you see? Nations are going to come from you and kings like David, Solomon, and then all the kings of Israel and Judah. Would that not be? So here's all the kings coming from you. And so there's going to be kings that are going to come out of you. And so you're going to be the father of many nations. And I will establish my covenant between me and you and your descendants after you for an everlasting covenant. You might underline that. We're going to make a point about that. This is an everlasting covenant to be God to you and your descendants after you. The idea of it being an everlasting covenant doesn't mean there is no end as much as it is signifying the surety that God's going to fulfill that. And I'll tell you why in just a moment. We'll come back to that. Now let's go to verse 8 to finish that section. I will give you and your descendants. Now here's the land promise. So the everlasting, might make a marginal note somewhere, the everlasting covenant in this context involves the land promise and the nation promise. Make sense? Land promise and the nation promise. Here's the land promise. I will give you and your descendants after you the land in which you are a stranger, all the land of Canaan as an everlasting possession, and I will be your God. Might underline everlasting possession. Did that mean they will keep that forever? No, because they didn't. This is the assurance that it was going to be fulfilled. Does that make sense? Because if the Jews are going to keep it forever, they hadn't kept all that land forever, have they? All right. We'll come back to that. We've not left that. All right, that's verses 1 to 8. What I want you to say, I'm going to make a point in a moment about the everlasting possession, everlasting promise, and then the sign in a moment. All right, now let's get 9 to 14. In 9 to 14, what's going on? Absolutely. Here's the rules for circumcision, but this is the mark of a chosen nation. This was the purpose of circumcision. So this is my covenant that is with you. Every male, verse 10, shall be circumcised, and you shall be circumcised them, notice, as a sign of the covenant. So what is circumcision? It was a sign of this covenant that God had made to Israel, concerning the land promise and the nation promise. Say more about that. Now verse 12, when are they to do that? on the eighth day. Time would forbid me to go into this, but I would refer you to Apologetics Press. Go to apologeticspress.org. That's put out by some of our institutional folks. But do a search for the circumcision on the eighth day. And you'll find this document that I'm looking at here, that there was a discovery found in 1935 and then one later in 1953, where vitamin K producing prothrombin, I think is how that's pronounced, that it's at its height on the eighth day and doesn't start to the third to the fifth day on a child. And it's at its highest, making it better for there to be a surgical process on the eighth day, not on the seventh, not on the ninth, but on the eighth day is when it's at its highest. And so I'm not a doctor. I'm not obviously, but I would refer you to the study by Holt and Milligan, and but that's all found in Bert Thompson's work on the circumcision on the eighth day. Do a little research on that, and you'll find that's quite interesting that the most logical day for that is not the seventh day, sixth day, or fifth day, or the ninth, or the tenth, or the twelfth, but that for clotting purposes, it's at that eighth day. Interesting. That's the day God chose. Seems like God knows what he's doing, doesn't it? All right. Now, what else do we learn about this principle of circumcision in verse 12 and 13? Yeah, anybody that's born in your house, any body that's bought, any slave, any one that comes into your household, they're to be circumcised. Now let's get down to the end of verse 13. My covenant shall be with your flesh for an everlasting covenant. Might underline that. Let's go and get verse 14, then I'm going to make some sense of what you've underlined there. That the circumcised male, the one who is not uncircumcised male, that's not circumcised, they'll be cut off from the nation. All right, so here's God's regulation concerning circumcision. Didn't start before this point. This is where that starts. It's a sign of that covenant. So we've talked about an everlasting covenant, everlasting possession, and here is a sign of that everlasting covenant. Now, why did I make that point? There's some of our own brethren who, and you might not have encountered this, who talk about the one covenant. We're under one covenant. They think the Old Testament law never did go away, that we're still under that law. So what's the significance of that? They're trying to blur the lines on teaching on divorce and remarriage primarily, though there are other things. And so this has permeated the Philippines, across the western states, this idea of one covenant. We're under one covenant. And this is one of the passages to which they appeal, that this is an everlasting covenant. Well, if everlasting covenant means we're under the same covenant, then everlasting possession means we receive the same land. I ain't got any land there, do you? Stephen, you've been to the land of Palestine. You own any part of it? Not an inch. Nobody else does that I know. All right? Does that then mean that we must have that everlasting sign of that everlasting covenant? We're still under the covenant, and we receive that eternal possession. Then are we to be circumcised? Well, our brethren don't believe that argue for the one covenant. But anyway, there's your answer to that misuse of the text. All right, let's go to 15 to 22 now. Abraham is promised seed that would come through Sarah. And so let's get her name changed starting at verse 15. That God said, as for Sarai, your wife, you will not call her Sarai, but Sarah shall be her name. And so what is the significance of her name change? I don't know. We're not told. Some suggest that both terms mean basically the same. Sarai and Sarah means princess. And some have suggested that there's no real reason that's given. It may be a new beginning, just like with her husband. He's got a new name. I'm giving her a new name. We're starting a new beginning. But I don't see anything in the text that tells me the significance of that name change for her. It's a name change. There is a difference. But what is the difference? I fail to see that. There is a reason, but what I'm saying is I don't see it in the text. Anybody see it? I may have missed it. All right. If you do, then I'd be glad to take a look at that. So now here's where we need to talk about Abraham's reaction. He fell on his face and laughed. Now she's going to do the same thing in chapter 18, but I'm not worried about that right now. I'm worried about him. He fell on his face and laughed. It doesn't seem to me that that is in ridicule, but perhaps in astonishment. I don't know about you, but I believe if somebody walked in the building and said, "We've been looking for you. Here is $10 million that belongs to you," I'd laugh. Not because I don't believe it. It's just like, this is unbelievable. I can't believe this is going on. That seems to me to be the case, more than ridicule. And you say, well, why do you say that? Well, notice how he bowed in reverence over here with God when God was giving him this covenant. And then later on at verse 23, when God tells him to be circumcised, he immediately that day goes and is circumcised. I don't think he's questioning God. Maybe he is, but I don't think so. But in his mind, he raises the question, how can one who is 100 years old, speaking of himself, and Sarah, 90 years old, bear a child? And oh, that Ishmael might live before you. In other words, is this the one through whom it's going to happen? And God's answer to that is no. Now, God names him, tells you, you're going to call him Isaac. What does that name mean? His name's going to be Isaac. And that means, his name means laughter. Maybe it's not, that's not in your footnote. But anyway, his name means laughter because both Abraham, later chapter 18, Sarah laughs, and I will establish my everlasting covenant through him. In other words, this is the one through whom this covenant's coming. So not only is the land promise going to come through him, the nation promise come through him, ultimately the seed promise goes through him. And so we've looked at that on a slide or two right here. That this is going to be through Abraham, Isaac, and then Jacob is going to be the lineage through which that's going to happen. All right. Now then, let's get on to something else here. At verse 20, concerning Ishmael, verse 20, what does he say? Ishmael's not going to be ignored. He's going to be blessed exceedingly. And there's going to be many nations. We've already noted that. Many nations come through him, and he shall beget 12 princes. It doesn't seem to me that it is just by coincidence that there will be 12 princes there, but through Isaac there's going to be 12 tribes. And so you want me to thread that together? I just did all I could do with that. But it doesn't seem by coincidence that that's the 12 and the 12. I don't know. Just think on that. But his covenant, he said, I will establish through Isaac, whom Sarah shall bear to you with you next year at this time. And then when he finished, he went up from Abram. Now let's finish the chapter. We're going to do some math here. I think we got time to do that. Abram and Ishmael were circumcised. Ishmael is how old at this point? 13, according to verse 25. But you might underline at verse 25 that Abraham took Ishmael and they were circumcised the very same day as God had said to him. When God said, this is your covenant, I want you to circumcise everyone, Abraham didn't put it off and think, well, I don't know about this. But he did it that very same day. Now look at verse 26, you might underline, that very same day Abram was circumcising his son Ishmael and all the men of his house. Now, I hadn't thought about this, but one writer made this observation. That was an act of faith. Without being graphic, that's a very painful operation. And that was an act of faith to just be obedient to God. But it was also, and this is what I hadn't thought about, an act of faith because that makes the whole clan vulnerable if they need war. Abraham's already had to fight a war back in chapter 14. And if they come under attack, these men are not in a position to fight, not for a while. So Abram had to have enough faith in God that God's not going to let somebody attack them. They're not going to need to fight. That was an act of faith. Instead of saying, well, let me circumcise some and not all the men because we need to have, but he circumcised them all. That's an act of faith because they're vulnerable if there is an attack. That's powerful. All right, let's do some math before we finish up and we'll be done. They've been in the land 24 years since the promise has been made. And so where do we get our numbers? Notice the 10 years mentioned in chapter 16 and in verse 10. They've dwelt in the land 10 years, and that's when Sarah says, you need to go in unto her, Hagar. All right, so take that 10, and from the time he was born, which may add another year there by the time he was born, but we know that by the time he's circumcised, he's 13. So let's take our 10 and our 13, and it was another year before Isaac is born, chapter 17, 21. So we're looking at 17, 25, 17, 21. So you take your 10 and 13 and 21, that's 24. And if there was a year from the time going in unto Hagar, at least 9 months, until, so approximately 25 years. So from the time God gave the promise in Genesis 12 to the fulfillment of Isaac being born is 25 years. That's a long time. And Abraham and Sarah begin to think, this ain't going to happen. This ain't going to happen. And try to help God out. And maybe we get discouraged when God maybe makes a promise and it's God's timetable doesn't always work like my timetable. Does that make sense? Time is about gone. Practical things you want to take home with you. Yeah. And it's interesting, too, to me that Abraham is well recognizing he wondered about having children. There's going to be even more children after this. Remember this, did we have it here just a minute ago? Let's see. I believe it's right. Maybe it's the next one. Anyway, this right here. We're going to get in chapter 25. He's going to have more children through Keterah. And so he thinks this is strange, you're going to have children now. He's going to have more children later. But what he's recognizing is after the flood, not only are the ages getting, they're dying younger, but the childbearing years are obviously getting younger. That's what Abraham is recognizing. Because Terah was older than Abram was when Isaac is born, I think, if I remember right. So, but by the end of the flood, things begin to get in a younger age. Does that make sense? And Abraham is recognizing that. That generally, as we look around, she's well beyond bearing years. Make sense? Anything else practical? We're going to be done here in a minute. Yeah. God doesn't need any help. Just wait and let God do it his way, because when we help him out, we make the wrong decision. Chapters 16 and 17. We'll start with 18 next time.